This is Arts Alive for this Saturday, December 10th. I'm Brian Lauritsen. On the program today, William Shakespeare died 4 centuries ago, and yet he remains the most performed playwright in the entire world. He even played a part in settling the Wild West.
There's incredible accounts of itinerant acting troops rolling into a small, dusty gold mining town and putting on Shakespeare. The miners would throw gold dust onto the stage if they liked a performance. There's accounts of them shooting actually at the villain if they found them too convincing.
Todd LaRue from the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, along with UCLA English professor Stephen Dickey, put a California spin on an exhibit about Shakespeare in America. We'll take you there, no gold dust required, later in today's program. Also today, Mozart in the Jungle reveals a whole new side of classical music to fans of the hit Amazon TV show. The newest season just debuted. In a moment, we take you to the red carpet to talk with some of the show's stars. And who's that guy hiding under the stage? It's the opera prompter. Dean Rob Cudiera of the USC Thornton School of Music has the scoop on prompters for Ask the Dean. First, here's Alan Chapman with the week's arts news.
From the Arts Desk today, a Beethoven expert in hot water and for Rostovsky leaving opera. There's a new wrinkle in the case of a disputed Beethoven manuscript. A handwritten Beethoven score failed to sell at a Sotheby's auction after its authenticity was called into question. But this week it came to light that one of the experts who claimed it was a fake tried to buy the manuscript himself at a much discounted price. Dr. Michael Laudenberger, head of the Beethoven House Museum, stands accused of conflict of interest and a breach of academic ethics. Dr. Laudenberger said in a speech at an international gathering of Beethoven experts that the 200-year-old artifact was a copy, not an original. And then he tried to get the current owner to sell it to the Beethoven House Museum for less than 1% of the price put on it by Sotheby's. Laudenberger told the UK newspaper The Telegraph, "I am well known as a serious and independent expert. The accusation is simply unfair and not applicable." And baritone Dmitri Khvorostovsky has canceled all his upcoming appearances. The 54-year-old is currently receiving treatment following the diagnosis of a brain tumor. Balance issues resulting from his condition have made performing staged operas difficult. He does intend to continue performing in concerts and the recording studio. Khvorostovsky was slated to play the title role in the Met performances of Tchaikovsky's Eugene Onegin in March and April, and he also had appearances scheduled in Vienna, Dresden, and London. All have been canceled. Khvorostovsky said in a statement, "Singing is my life, and I want to continue bringing joy to people worldwide. With this pause in my operatic career and more rest in between each engagement, I hope to have more time to focus on my health and treatment." That's the arts news for Saturday, December 10th. On this date in 1884, Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn was published. It was immediately criticized for its coarse language, and several libraries banned it from their shelves. The Concord, Massachusetts Public Library Committee called it rough, coarse, and inelegant, dealing with a series of experiences not elevating, the whole book being more suited to the slums than to intelligent, respectable people. For Arts Alive, I'm Alan Chapman.
This is Arts Alive on Classical KUSC. I'm Brian Lauritsen. An oboist's 2005 memoir, Mozart in the Jungle, Sex, Drugs, and Classical Music, threw back the curtain to show a side of the classical music world that would surprise anyone who thinks of its musicians as elite stoic men and women in black formal wear. The book inspired Amazon's streaming TV show, Mozart in the Jungle, about an eccentric South American conductor who raises eyebrows at the helm of the New York Symphony. The show's third season is just out now. KUSC's Gail Eichenthal went to its Los Angeles premiere to talk to some of the show's stars on the red carpet.
What I've discovered about this world is that all artists have the same kind of passion, and that we shouldn't think of people who commit their lives to classical music as like elite or boring or old-fashioned, but like in fact, like Mozart was a rock star in his day, and it all begins there.
That was Lola Kirk. She plays Haley Rutledge, the show's up-and-coming oboist. Actor Gael Garcia Bernal plays conductor Rodrigo de Souza. In the first season of the show, the young conductor's new symphony cooks up an ad campaign called Hear the Hair. So, a young South American conductor with an expressive head of curly hair? If that sounds familiar, it's no accident.
Well, certainly, I mean, the fact that there was a character written from Latin America that was conducting an orchestra in the United States, it was Dudamel. Well, without him, it wouldn't have existed. Not because it hasn't happened before, because there had been, you know, I mean, there is a whole world of course, of classical music in Latin America, but Dudamel brought new face, you know, a fresh air. So Rodrigo sort of exists thanks to that, thanks to him in a way. And also thanks to the work that El Maestro Abreu does, you know, because, I mean, Dudamel wouldn't have existed, you know, without, and many musicians all over the world right now wouldn't be playing the music and wouldn't be professionals if it wasn't because of El Sistema. And also many people to appreciate music, even though they don't dedicate themselves professionally to music, El Sistema has done a great job to spread it. And I feel such a privilege to be able to discover it myself, like, firsthand. And not only that, like, I have an opportunity now to conduct, for example, every now and then, to enjoy the music. It's a journey inward, this series, for me. I learn a lot. I learn every day.
Gael Garcia Bernal is the Dudamel-inspired conductor on Mozart in the Jungle. Dudamel himself has even appeared on the show. He had a cameo in the second season as a Hollywood Bowl stagehand, trying to convince Rodrigo to come conduct in Los Angeles. The show's new season introduces a new character, a Maria Callas-like diva that inspires conductor Rodrigo on and off the stage.
My heart, it has been bleeding for a while. And I think your voice is the only thing that can save it.
The diva is played by Monica Bellucci, but the character's singing voice is soprano Ana Maria Martinez.
How much singing is involved?
Several arias, duets, a few scenes here and there, a little bit of a cappella singing, with several days of recording a couple of months back, right before they started shooting. So we needed to make sure that everything was done to allow Monica time to prepare it so she could lip sync it and get used to that. And I have to remember at this moment someone who's no longer with us, but Marnie Nixon, who provided the singing voice for so many of our favorite actresses in movies back in the 50s and 60s, most famous for West Side Story, where Natalie Wood played Maria and Marnie did the singing. So she's always been one of my heroines. I bless her wherever her soul is right now, thinking of her tonight.
So it's such an interesting sort of side gig for you to be being part of this Amazon streaming series that has caught on, I think, beyond anyone's dreams. So what made you want to be a part of this?
I love the series, and I love the concept of the series, of making classical music first and foremost a leading character, a leading theme. And it speaks to the passion that we all share for music. It means that it's timeless. It reinforces that. Music is a connector, a unifier. And especially classical music, as so many of the pieces we listen to today that aren't classical music come from the roots of classical music. So it's important to know that. In a way, it's knowing the history of where all of the wonderful things we listen to today come from.
A lot of the actors were saying here on the red carpet that they have realized the whole art form is much less elitist and scary than they thought it was, and that they're trying to send the message, this is music for everyone. Mm-hmm.
That's true. It's music for everyone. And we have to remember that classical music at the time it was written was the popular music of the day. So it was always for everyone. That was originally the intention. So it's important that we really return to that concept. It truly is for everyone. And it inspires us to dream and think and feel. And in particular, having an opera diva and the concept of opera in there, it's the one art form that unites all of the art forms. And opera is the most collaborative of all the art forms. So I love personally that it's being featured so highly.
What's coming up for you on the operatic stage?
On the operatic stage, I will get to do my first Tatiana in Eugene Onegin with the Lyric Opera of Chicago. I have a concert tour with Andrea Bocelli, also preparing a return to Royal Opera House Covent Garden as Madame Butterfly. for this coming season. And I just did Faust in Houston Grand Opera. So it's been already a pretty full calendar. And also I'm very, very blessed to work with Plácido Domingo in many concerts throughout the world.
Has he been an important mentor?
Absolutely. Plácido Domingo is not only one of the greatest artists that we've ever seen, greatest men of not just his time, but I think the kind of individual that comes around maybe once every 100 or 200 years. Tremendous gracious spirit, and he leads by example. So when I get to work with him, not only do I see how he gives everything he has artistically to his audience with complete abandon, but also his gracious spirit, his professionalism, his kindness, and that's an example to emulate throughout one's life, not just in one's work, but in one's life.
You can hear Ana Maria Martinez in Mozart in the Jungle's third season. It's available now through Amazon's streaming service. KUSC's Gail Eichenthal spoke with two more of the show's stars, Bernadette Peters and Malcolm McDowell. You can see what they had to say on the Arts Alive blog, which you can find at kusc.org. And thanks also to KUSC intern Rose Campion for her help with this story. You're listening to Arts Alive here on Classical KUSC. I'm Brian Lauritsen. I hope you'll join us next week when we talk to Sir Simon Rattle of the Berlin Philharmonic and explore a new movie inspired by poet Pablo Neruda. That's next Saturday morning at 8 on Arts Alive. You can catch up with past episodes of Arts Alive anytime with the podcast at kusc.org. Right now, here once again is Alan Chapman with the week's Around Town Arts Calendar.
Here's a bit of what's happening around town, starting, as we always do, with a free event. The 72nd Annual Candlelight and Carols Concert at Pasadena Presbyterian Church is today. Sacred and secular music of the Christmas season, plus an audience sing-along and not one but two handbell choirs. Those concerts are at 4:30 and 7:30 today. Candlelight and Carols at the Pasadena Presbyterian Church on Colorado Boulevard. Details at ppcmusic.org. And again, admission is free. St. James Sunday Concerts in Tarzana presents Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas tomorrow, a holiday program that features their choirs and early music ensemble with music by Telemann, Rossini, Offenbach, Handel, Mendelssohn, and carols from around the world. A concert tomorrow at 4 p.m. at St. James Presbyterian Church on Ventura Boulevard in Tarzana. Information at stjamespres.org. And at the Sierra Madre Playhouse, A Little House Christmas, a play with songs about the Ingalls family, which has moved from the big woods to their little house on the prairie, and the family, of course, is looking forward to the coming Christmas holiday. There are performances of A Little House Christmas through December 23rd, and tickets are available at sierramadreplayhouse.org. And that's a bit of what's happening around town this week. For details on these and other cultural events in Southern California, visit performingartslive.com. For Arts Alive, I'm Alan Chapman.
Coming up on Arts Alive, we ask the Dean, but first, America's Shakespeare, The Bard Goes West, is a California spin on an exhibition that originated at the Folger Shakespeare Library in D.C., and it's on view now at L.A.'s Central Library. The eclectic exhibition was curated by Stephen Dickey, senior lecturer in the Department of English at UCLA, and Todd LaRue, project manager for the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. KUSC's Kelsey McConnell asked them both, starting with LaRue, if it was difficult to find Ole Will in California's history.
Well, it's one of those things that when you start looking for something, you begin to see it everywhere. So I don't know if we thought that it would be difficult going into it, but we were certainly surprised by what we did find once we started looking. The fact that Hermosa Beach was first called Shakespeare Beach when the red cars opened there in 1906, the developers were hoping that it would become a writer's colony, so they named the beach and the neighborhood Shakespeare and the surrounding streets after other writers, Hawthorne and Tennyson. And already by the 1920s, those names had disappeared. But we were able to find early photograph labeling it as Shakespeare Beach.
The spread of Shakespeare in the theaters of America in the 19th century is pretty well established. But the extraordinary devotion to his works in the northern part of the state, especially in the Gold Rush era, was very impressive. I can't say that was a discovery exactly, except to me. There's an enormous hunger culturally for theater at that time, and you can tell by the fact that constantly natural disasters are occurring. Theaters are burning down, and they're rebuilt almost immediately, over and over again.
There's incredible accounts of itinerant acting troupes rolling into a small, dusty gold mining town and putting on Shakespeare. It's what the miners knew and wanted to see. They would throw gold dust onto the stage if they liked a performance. There's accounts of them shooting actually at the villain if they found them too convincing. So it's really fascinating to be able to see a little bit more of this part of California's history through the lens of theater and Shakespeare specifically. And you can't really talk about Shakespeare in Los Angeles or in California without looking to the movie industry. Some of the very earliest silent films, even without being able to use the text, they were still looking to Shakespeare to tell their stories, and we have some of those films playing in the exhibition. And then we've highlighted a few additional productions that took place here, notably the 1934 Midsummer Night's Dream that happened at the Hollywood Bowl, directed by famous director Max Reinhardt. We have some wonderful artifacts related to that production, invitations to the premiere, photographs of the whole cast on the stage of the Hollywood Bowl with Mickey Rooney as Puck right in the center. And that production was so well known and so popular at the time that it was turned into a movie by Warner Brothers the following year. And we have some artifacts related to the film version as well.
The first part of the exhibit was a kind of a surprise to me. I obviously recognized the name John Wilkes Booth for being Lincoln's assassin, but I had no idea about the legacy of the rest of his family, especially when it came to bringing Shakespeare west. Can you talk a little bit about the Booth family?
The first Booth to come west was the oldest son, who was in the profession, Junius Brutus Booth Jr. He was wanting to start a theater company and manage a company, and with the Gold Rush follows the money to Northern California. He asks his father, who was one of the major stars of the early 19th century American stage, J.B. Sr., and his younger brother Edwin to come out as well. It's a matter of the youth of John Wilkes Booth, but John Wilkes Booth does not come to California. So the three Booths are out here, and they are putting on plays. Edwin is quite young, in his late teens, early 20s, and his job has been mainly to keep his father sober and sane enough to act. And he has not done that much acting, a little bit here and there. But he really begins to start his career when the father becomes disgusted with the low paydays and goes back to the East Coast. So Edwin is more or less on his own with his older brother. That really launches Edwin as a figure of some importance in the theater. I was fascinated to discover the Edwin Booth connection to this geographical area. Booth's descendants eventually donated a lot of family memorabilia to the special collections at Cal State Northridge. So we were able to use some of those artifacts and also to reproduce a recording of Edwin Booth's voice, which was made in 1890. And he is speaking a selection from Act One, Scene Three of Othello. And you can hear it. They're static, but you can get a sense of the subtlety and the nuance of his acting style, which was rather unlike the norm at the time.
There's another part of the exhibit that stood out to me because I think it shows how Shakespeare has been adopted by different communities as their own kind of special voice. There's a quote posted from Maya Angelou that says, "Of course he was a black woman. I understand that. Nobody else understands it, but I know that Shakespeare was a black woman." And then there's also a quote from a Mexican playwright who says, "Shakespeare is Mexican because he speaks our language." So what do you think it is about this one playwright that has allowed so many people from all different ages and countries to feel like he speaks for them?
That's a question I wish I could answer easily. I was struck doing some research for the exhibition how many statements you could find from how many different languages and cultures that are directly analogous to the Maya Angelou quotation. Everybody wants to view Shakespeare, or somehow has come to view Shakespeare, as entirely local to him or her. I think, frankly, partly it has to do with just the sheer copiousness of this man's writing. I mean, for leaving aside the complexity and compelling nature of his language and plots, there's just so much of it that you can sooner or later bump into yourself in a character or in a moment. I think it's also to do with the larger historical cut and thrust of English colonialism and the spread of that literature. And that's certainly part of the story. Universal is the term that was rather glibly applied to him, but I think he's as close as we come to that.
It's definitely one of the major themes that we want to put forward in the exhibit, that Shakespeare does appear in all of these different, sometimes unexpected places, and really is for everybody.
Of all of the things that are on display, do either of you have particular favorites or things that you think are especially remarkable or exciting?
Well, in the first folio, I think that is very important. The first publication attempt to gather all of Shakespeare's plays, published in 1623. Without this book, about a third of the plays would have been lost to history, plays like Macbeth, Julius Caesar, Twelfth Night, and we're very fortunate to be able to show a copy of this. We have a letter from Abraham Lincoln to an actor describing Macbeth as his favorite play. There's manuscripts from writers like Emily Dickinson, Walt Whitman, either speaking about Shakespeare's impact in America or using him as a reference in stories that they were working on. There's a wonderful, beautiful quilt by the quilt maker Patty Elwin Davis, depicting various scenes from very many Shakespeare plays, and it's a real testament to the devotion that people have felt towards Shakespeare. Hundreds of hours must have gone into this one piece.
I have a lot of favorites. Some of them are a little off the beaten track. The first published in America picture of Shakespeare, an engraving, it is part of an advertisement for a stationery store. I guess this assumption is if you buy paper and ink from us, you will be able to write like Shakespeare.
The other wonderful part of the exhibition, we've built a stage with a beautiful castle on the hill and some waves, and you figure out which character you are, and then we have props and scripts so you can get up on the small stage and read some lines, and we've seen families coming in and performing for each other and really taking advantage of this fun element of the exhibition.
The Library Foundation's Todd LaRue and UCLA professor Stephen Dickey speaking with KUSE's Kelsey McConnell. You can try to woo Juliet or take on Hamlet right now at the Central Library. The exhibition is called America's Shakespeare, The Bard Goes West. Plus, 22 branch libraries are participating with their own Shakespeare-inspired programs. Everything from fencing demonstrations to sonnet writing workshops. Read all about it at the Library Foundation of Los Angeles' website, and that is lfla.org. Now here's Gail Eichenthal with a question about directing divas and divos for Dean Rob Cudietta of the USC Thornton School of Music.
Finally, the prompter gets their due. Thanks to a question from Russ and Denise of Paso Robles, Dean Rob Cudietta. They, a few months ago, watched one of those wonderful HD Met productions of Manon Lescaut. And at the end, when the performers took their bows, the tenor, Roberto Alagna, ran straight to the prompter to give special thanks. Apparently, he had taken the role at the last minute, and he wanted to
show his appreciation for the help of the prompter to make that a successful performance. So Russ and Denise are wondering, what precisely does a prompter do during the performance, before the performance? Do they give verbal cues, stage directions, or just quietly pray that everything works and no one needs the prompter?
Yes. You know what? First, I think we have to talk about what a prompter is. But I went to Ken Kazan, who's our stage director for the Thornton Opera, and talked with him about this. So first of all, when you go to see an opera, you'll often see something coming up from the stage that looks like, what is that unusual little box there?
And it's almost invisible, at least at LA Opera, Dorothy Chandler Pavilion. Yeah. You have to be on stage to look directly down into what looks like maybe a home for a groundhog.
Yeah, exactly. So you don't really see it, but in others you do see it. And in there, there's a person. There's a person in there, a very animated person usually. Yeah. So it's good that the audience doesn't see them because it would be quite distracting. That's the prompter. And so you think of it like a teleprompter. It's really a people prompter in a lot of ways. That person is there right in front of the actors, the singers, and they're there to help. They're all kinds of things. So sometimes you can even hear them shouting out, you know, the beginnings of lines, or if they get lost, whatever, they're going to be there to help them. They can do stage directions. They're there for everything, to help them keep on track. If a line is forgotten, if they get lost in a piece of music, they're there to help them. And they do it verbally and through gestures. Because they are in some kind of enclosure, the audience isn't going to hear them do this. So they can shout things out sometimes even, and it's going to work. So probably the reason that I've never seen a prompter acknowledged like this. So my guess is that probably this person came in late and had to learn it and was so dependent on this person helping them through that they really appreciated them more than usual. Prompters are actually becoming, in some camps, kind of passé, partially because the singers are so much better prepared than perhaps they were at one time. They spend more time on a production. They can really work on that production for a while, so it's not as necessary. It goes back to a time when there were just so many performances and they were doing different kinds of performances that they needed that kind of crutch person in there. But they're still very, very popular and play an extremely important role.
I also wonder, you know, we used to talk about the Park and Bark school of opera performances where you were just basically standing there on stage. And since direction is such a big part of today's opera world, moving around, sometimes interacting with projections and animation, as in the Barry Kosky productions we've seen in L.A. and elsewhere, you need to be able to be more flexible, to move around the stage, sometimes walking upside down as in the fly. So I think the singers and actors need to be better trained.
They do need to be better trained because, again, with the fly, if you're upside down, you're probably not going to be looking to the prompter for, and if they would, it'd be upside down. So, and you're right, they're moving across the stage so much more, and they utilize so much more of the stage, that you're probably right that it's not as easy to always just glance to where the prompter is. You might be quite far away from them or not even within sight of them. So that's probably another reason.
But thanks to Russ and Denise for finally giving the prompter their due.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Dean Rowe.
Thanks, Gail.
Do you have a question about music, dancers, musicians, or instruments? Dean Rob Kudieta and his team of experts will find your answer. All you have to do is send an email to this address, askthedean@kusc.org. Once again, that's askthedean@kusc.org. And if you want to check out Ask the Dean in book form, now you can. Dean Rob has put together a compilation of queries in the book Who Knew? Answers to questions about classical music you never thought to ask. Great holiday gift idea, and it's available in stores and online, Amazon and elsewhere. Who Knew? Answers to questions about classical music you never thought to ask. From Dean Rob Kudieta. And that wraps up this edition of Arts Alive for this Saturday, the 10th of December. Join us next week when we talk to Sir Simon Rattle of the Berlin Philharmonic and explore a new movie inspired by poet Pablo Neruda. That's next Saturday morning at 8 on Arts Alive. The technical director is Mark Hatwan. Kelsey McConnell is the executive producer. We had help this week from KUSE intern Rose Campion, plus KUSE's Gail Eichenthal and Alan Chapman. Thanks as well to Sheila Tepper. I'm Brian Lauritsen. Have a great weekend.